Can, in, I think the best thing for, if you're going to work on this, is for us to look at one or two things to do with additional reading that you might do towards these things. And if we have a moment, I'll come back to that reading or something, but I don't want to go on beyond that today. I think, first of all, I think you might watch the kind of career this is, first of all. There's no appreciation of Stevens worth speaking about until about 1950, when he was over 70. This is one of these cases where criticism and an environment of careful reading is not available to the poet, you understand. Which means he's developing very much along his own lines. I think this is one of the reasons, partly at least here, I think, is where one can indicate that some of the reasons for Stevens's repetitiveness. He's that kind of figure, to my mind, that there's not exactly insularity, but there's a certain hermetic quality about his work, isn't there? It seems to me. It doesn't sort of, you don't get the feeling that he's been prodded with additional evidence from outside very often, if you know what I mean, in that way. Well, anyway, for whatever use it is to you, I mentioned that. The date really is Harmonium, his first book, is 1923, and that sold less than 100 copies. That was his first book of poems. They'd been appearing in little magazines, but very few. And this is incredible for this fact, but it's true, that only two poems were published between 1924 and 1930, at all, anywhere. But he was fairly well off, increasingly so. He worked in insurance. Like Charles Ives, also another insurance man. The next fact is that 1931, Harmonium was reissued, but with only a dozen poems about added. I say dozen in the sort of round figure. And then it's after that he becomes fairly prolific. Now he was born in 1879. So you can see the kind of career this is. A fairly prolific period in the 1930s and 1940s. It's fairly late, you see, in life. I mentioned this because, you know, we were talking about this then, when we were talking about Keats and Sheffield, that one really must remember these very young people. I mean, that's no point in treating Shelley and Keats as so many critics do, as if they were like finished old men who had like 80 years to work it out. You know what I mean? It's ludicrous stupidity to do that, and cruel. The greatness of those people. And one of Stevens is something else, and I think one must watch that there is this period of real, very strong development, very late in life, you see, and there's an enormous career, 1879 to 1955. You see what I mean? You could tuck several Keats' careers into that. I think it's important to watch the curve of a man's career, don't you think, and how long he had to do it. When his prolific period came, so on. Do you understand what I mean? Otherwise, treating all poets as if they have the same kind of career is ludicrous. And it goes on, does it not? It's very difficult to tell from criticism whether anybody cares about that sort of thing. They were human beings, after all. You know, how much time they had, and what did they do, and so on. And then I think the next stage you wanted the collected poems, 1955, of course. They weren't collected in any, they weren't complete in any sense. Then after that, there is this volume, Opus Posthumus, which is a disgraceful piece of scholarship, but is in fact useful because it does contain some other things, and this came out in 59. Opus Posthumus contains a couple of plays and a lot of early work. If you're looking at it, look first, I suggest, at the back, because it's got the dates of the items, and this is very important because, quite frankly, the stuff up to about 1920 is pretty trivial. also, it's one of those books that, the poet, like a professional poet, carefully scars things he doesn't want as soon as he's dead. they put it all back, sort of book. You know, I think it's disgraceful. I mean, you don't trust a poet like Walter Stevens to know what he wants. I mean, who the hell do you think you are? But nevertheless, it is useful because there are one or two things in it which do come after the collective, you see, that's the point. So that's useful in that way. But look at the dates at the back. Also, some of the prose pieces, I forgot to say that, some of the prose pieces at the back is very nice. The piece on William Carlos Williams, which I like very much. And there's a piece on Marianne Moore and so on. There's about a third of the book at the back is prose. I'm going to use one of them in a minute to show you, I hope. So here's a poet then who is at the opposite pole of men like Robert Frost, for instance, who is an increasingly popular poet. And I think one, if you're thinking about American poetry, you might ask yourself about this. I mean, exactly what sort of popularity you have in Frost, and then exactly why it is that this kind of poet, Stevens, is not so. I mean, just among people who read poetry, are popular. One of the reasons, let's not talk about that, let's move, because it's a very difficult thing to talk about anyway. Let's ask ourselves why it is that even among the critical cognoscenti of poetry and so on, who latch onto anything that seems to be all good, he didn't get it. I think I must remember very much the whole of this period is dominated by T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden. Now, of all the poets I can think of who's unlike those two, it's this one. And I mean by that there is absolutely none of Auden's, of Eliot's nostalgia for lost traditions, religious, philosophical, political, governmental, at all. There's none of that sense of, like, that I live in a time of collapse, and you have to go back, you know, to recover to associate that sensibility, which is a dissociation of sensibility, you know. I mean, there's none of that nostalgia in Eliot. And I think in Auden, I think that combination of first Freud, then Christianity is missing out from Stevens, right? I mean, the thing that distinguishes Auden from Eliot, basically, is they're both pretty traditional looking people, in spite of the vision, like appearance of the contrary in Auden. Certainly the analysis in Auden moves off from Freud. One must remember that 30s group of poets are leftish in various degrees, and Freudian. Which separates them off. Gradually, you notice, though, that they move towards positions of extreme Toryism. I was thinking of the position taken up now by Isherwood, Auden, C.J. Lewis, and so on. And Louis MacNeice became a sort of, I don't know, spectator liberal. I mean, you know, available for the third program, which means harmless, but able to articulate a sort of agonized liberalism, you know, in those plays, which are the best things in the video. If you want to do some work on this, you would have to put Louis MacNeice, he's the most distinguished of all this crowd, the Autumn Journal of Louis MacNeice, you see, with some of these things in Stevens, and a bit of the, like, Autumn Spain and so on. You see, this is the kind of job that we ought to be doing, but, like, we don't have time. But this would be very interesting, you know, to think of just what is being articulated and how is it being done. I just want to suggest that Wallace Stevens had no allegiances then, you see, to grid structures of Freudianism, leftist stuff, and nostalgias for past civilizations at all, you want to watch. And also, in connection with Robert Frost, I think one might say that there's no kind of, there's no interest in something else we find in Eliot too, in the original sin at all. And there's no suggestion at all, as you get in Frost, that anti-intellectualism, anti-analysis is the great safeguard. Remember that famous poem, which I think we looked at when we were doing Frost maybe in the secondary, I forget.
But certainly, if you want the poem that will reveal to you Frost's position vis-à-vis Stevens,
Eliot and Auden,
it will be a poem called Build Soil, which he wrote in 1931 as a 5-year gap poem to liberate Colombia, just at the moment when President Roosevelt was standing for election, on the ground that given the capitalism had collapsed, surely you'd need planning.
No, that's kind of imagery.
And Frost's poem says no. Dialogue, and the gist of the dialogue is, it's a partial dialogue, Vice President, I just let things go on as they are, and then take credit for any consequences they were taking credit for. It's the most crass form of naturalistic laissez-faire I've read for years. And plus the arrogance of saying, if anything did like come my way, I'd take it, this thing. The reason is why President Kennedy chose Frost as his inaugural poet, you know, up there, that as a capitalist, Kennedy couldn't possibly have anybody that existed in any magical. So that one understands the layout there in relationship to the 1931 poem and the Kennedy desire to have this old guy yashing into a microphone at the inaugural. The sun got in his eyes. I thought Wallace Stevens must have liked very much. And that famous phrase in Sunday Morning about the chaos of the old sun. So, this is something else then in Stevens. I think, first of all, one says the landscape is very different to Frost, too. I mean, that agonized New England sort of landscape. The landscape of work and rocks and clearing ground and, you know, this kind of farmy, worky place. And then the mountains are rather sinister. It's replaced in Stevens by what we saw last time. I think the best example is identified by that poem that I quoted a little bit from, Sea Surfaces, where the Florida Sea and the clouds are his great image of pleasure, of sensuousness. And there's this degree of sensuousness, of open sensuous experience. Practically all his poems are strongly rooted in sensuous pleasure, sensuous experience of some kind, which really separates him off, I think, from a lot of things. So, the next thing one wants to say is I think that if he's near anybody, he's probably near William Carlos Williams along these lines. They were great friends. And that is to do with the fact that they were both trying to work out what this human universe is. I think a quotation from Marianne Moore actually will help here. She wrote in connection with Wallace Stevens, and she talked about his work like this. What the poet has is not a solution, but some defense against the world as it is. There's a very defensive thing going on in Wallace Stevens. I don't think I brought this out enough last time. You get the feeling that he's not radically a revolutionary figure, he's a defensive one in many ways, I think. Yet I must hang on to that idea of pleasure. Now, I think then there's a quotation here from Stevens. Which I think is quite useful. I think I'll give that a little bit later on, actually. I thought that they might come there. Sorry about that. Right. So, I thought I'd do that to you. That's kind of rude, but I just suddenly realized it was coming a bit later on. Now, I think that we talked about that formal business of the fact that he usually writes in iambics. There's very little else, except iambic structures, of a pretty sort of generalized kind.
I think one of the ways you could point to quite easily something you could use here would be an example of how the calm gaze of the poet comes out in the iambics. It's a long poem, but I give you the one verse. It's a poem called Chocorua, 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 to its neighbour. The verse I want is on page 300 of the collected poems. And you'll see that I think it's verse 19 of Chocorua, to its neighbour. I think that is a verse you could like memorise as an instance of what it is, what sort of form of speech that Towns seems concerned with. To say more than human things with human voice, that cannot be. To say human things with more than human voice, that also cannot be. To speak humanly from the height or from the depth of human beings, that is acutest speech. It's a very utilitarian idea, you know. There's a strong suggestion, if you see. That's a wrong suggestion there, that you find a pretty sort of general technique for handling. You don't invent forms continually of exciting sound. He's not the kind of poet that is interested in inventing structures, elaborating structures. There's a kind of an aim to find a practical working commonplace level of metrics, you see. That's the kind of thing. I mean, you think of the sheer inventiveness of one page in Patterson or in the Peas and Cantos of Pound. You see, I'm trying to find ways of saying that kind of, it is somehow what's a very utilitarian working iambic meter, as you see. But I think that gives the clue why verse 19 of Chocorua to its neighbours. I think too, if you look at the other poets, Yeats, Eliot, Auden. I mean, Auden's inventiveness is incredible. He's still at it, and one feels that a lot of energy goes into this with these other poets. In Stevens, he'll risk the boredom of it, and he's not interested in free verse. You notice. It's another way of differentiating him at all. There's no concern at all anywhere in his work with free verse, right? That kind of. There are places where you can hear Whitman. The sound sounds like Whitman. I was reading The Rock this morning again. You know, this kind of stuff. When he's talking about Buds and Doom, I won't go into the context. I can hear those Whitman cadences in my head when I listen. They bud the whitest eye, the pallidest sprout, new senses in the engendering of sense, the desire to be at the end of distances, the body quickened and the mind in root. They bloom as a man loves, as he loves in love. They bear the fruit so that the year is known, as if its understanding was brown skin. You know, that movement, I feel it very strongly there. Is the movement in a thing like The Sleepers or Crossing Brooklyn Ferry? You know, I don't want to go into the other story, but it really is that. I mean, I can hear it in my head when I read that. And again and again, the Whitman rhythms are inside the iambics, but I don't think there's anything like the risks taken, you know, in Whitman. You see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to like delineate exactly what sort of form is here, which is part of obviously the subject of the poetry, always in that particular way. And now the quotation will work. You need to take it down, it's just an indication. My intention in poetry is to reach and express that which, without any particular definition, everyone recognizes to be poetry. You know, there's an aim for a certain mediocrity, a certain commonplace. And because I feel the need for doing it, I'm rather inclined to disregard form. The essential thing in form is to be free in whatever form is used. A free form does not assure freedom. So as it comes to this, I suppose, that I believe in freedom regardless of form.
It's difficult what the Stephen Statute.
Do you want me to read that at all again? Do you want
read it again.
Yeah, right.
Is it?
Oh, God, it's a private letter. It's probably been there, but I don't know. It's a letter to Marianne Moore, which she quoted in an essay. As I was saying the other week, I don't have the letters, and I've not read them yet. May I call for the cost settings? And only the rich can afford that. No, the reading right, John, sorry. That was how. No, I don't mean that, I'm just jealous. Okay, let me read it very slowly. Then you can take it down as you like. My intention in poetry is to reach and express that which, comma, my intention in poetry is to reach and express that which, comma, without any particular definition, everyone recognizes to be poetry. That sounds a bit kind of dull. But then I think what falls off that will show you why he wants to get that way. Full stop. And because I feel the need for doing it, I'm rather inclined to disregard form. The essential thing in form is to be free in whatever form is used. Then a free form does not assure freedom. And in the last sentence, that I believe in freedom regardless of form. Understand, this is not a public, utterance. This is a letter to Marianne Moore. The only reference I've got for it is, if it's any use to you, but I doubt it, is the same place that I got her word about, Stephen. It's the New York Review of Books. You know, this thing that comes out of well, nice magazine. New York Review of Books, June 25th, 1964. New York Review of Books, June 25th, 1964. And she quotes him saying that in that article. That's what I've got. Have you got it?
No, I haven't, but could I just throw in a sentence that you'll
please, yeah. Do, John.
This is from a letter to Delmore Schwartz.
What date is it? You better give the date if anybody wants
it.
April
26th, 1948.
April 26th?
Yeah.
1948. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Poetic form, in its proper sense, is a question of what appears within the poem itself. It seems worthwhile to isolate this because it is always form in its inimical senses that destroys poetry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that in its inimical sense is the bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, right. I think this goes with it. I mean, he knows very well, as soon as you imitate a form of a poem, you imitate the reason for that form. Which means that's why form is content, in fact, you see, because the structuring of your sensibility in language is part of what the poem is conveying to the reader, isn't it? So if someone uses heroic couplets in 1813, say 14, it means something rather different to a poem, you see what I mean? That's what one might say. I mean, the urge to make that kind of structuring. Okay, that's a bit out of the way. I'm sorry I had to leave it, that quotation, but you see, I think you'll be able to see why now. Yes, I think now I'd like to mention one or two other poems you might look at, just a handful, to show you where you could quote if you wanted to. Sunday Morning we've not looked at, but it's a very straightforward poem. But it, again, this idea of the main phrase there is this idea of which he uses in Credence of Summer and in Esthétique du Mal, but it's in a very straightforward early form. The idea of the old chaos of the sun. That, you know, that if you make order out of the universe, you make order out of the universe. But it's there very clearly in Sunday Morning, a very famous poem. Not very difficult, but you can quote it. Obviously, the title Sunday Morning suggests an analysis of traditional meanings for the Sabbath and all that. Where she says, where he says, at the end, it's in the last verse, verse 8, we live in an old chaos of the sun, or old dependency of day and night, or island solitude, unsponsored, free of that wide water, inescapable. Deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness. And in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. Now you see, there are absolutely no metaphors in that structure at all. At the end of this poem, which is analysing the structure of Sunday morning, and references to sun gods of various kinds, Christ and so on, but it ends with a description of how the earth is after it broke off, exploded from the sun, you see. Ironic that we're in old chaos, broken off the sun, and the sun has always been like the order centre, hasn't it? You know, it's the sky god origin, the heat origin and so on. His irony is, we're just a bit broken off on that central order. But note, it can be described without metaphors and without reference to the sun. You see his point there at the end, which is like what we were talking about last time, to do with humorism. Okay, so that everything else is supreme fiction. But notice that when he writes a poem, Paul notes towards the supreme fiction, it's toward. That is, the fiction is never entirely managed. It's never entirely complete. You see, it's a philosophical idea. You find in Wittgenstein and in the scientists like Heisenberg that you're forever making descriptions. And that is the programs you have, you make descriptions. But the idea of anything more than supreme fiction will be hubris against human beings. So he's philosophical and modern in that sense. In a poem, not a short poem which you might like to check out, it's called Aside on an Oboe. Typical, like, cheeky title. He's pretty fond of those titles for that kind of thing. Lots of doings. I just want to quote passages from it. Because that's an awful lot. I thought I'd like to take the risk of. Like a fool, didn't make a note of the darn thing. Blast. Oh, it's in there, is it? I thought it was. Okay, what page is it?
It's fine.
Thanks very much. I'm sorry, I'm wasting precious time. That's right, yeah, I've got the down thing marked. it's quite a short poem, but it's the idea here again that the fiction is involved in belief, and that opening section.
Can I
look
at your
room? Yeah, look at me. Here. The prologues are over. It's a question now of final belief. So, say that final belief must be in a fiction. It's time to choose. And then he does his bit of, alternate version in three sections. It's good to prepare and take if you don't have much time with a class there, something like that. And then you see the phrase, the central man.
That idea of the central man or the major man he's looking for is the person who can do this, you know, who can live this out. But it's always towards the definition of central man, major man, in that way. He knows very difficult that if the final belief must be in a fiction, to disgrace. Final belief must be in a fiction. The major man is in a condition of living through descriptions. And this is really what his poetry is about. It's quite limited in that sense, to my mind.
Can I just go back?
Yeah, do.
You said that he was a very defensive poet.
Yeah.
I want to think that
the reverse. I mean defensive in the sense that you get this guitar.
He's been very aggressive.
Yeah. No, I don't. Yes, I think there's a sense in which he looks that way. But there is a sense that where you get the feeling that I get the feeling that given that he's working within that area, I'm thinking of Walt Stevens as a whole. I'm thinking of his, I must admit, I'm thinking of his essays too. And I've not read the letters, but certainly the poems. It does come, I'm not saying he's entirely defensive, I think there's a defensive element here, very defensive poet. I mean, in a time when allegiances were being given continually to Catholicism, communism, Freudianism, I mean, between 1920 and 1950 is the great ism period, you know. And he will not. I mean, there is no allegiance to any of that in his work. You might say, well, isn't there an allegiance to capitalism? I think the answer would be yes, but I think, right. Yes, I think that, but I would want to say that, but I don't want to repeat what I think, you know, what I was saying last week. I think that the only way I can conceive of making Wallace Stevens available, I don't feel he's an aggressive capitalist poet at all. I feel he's that poet we were talking about last time, you know, the one that's projecting this ledger of society. Well, we did all that.
That's what I
really meant,
the fact that he's projecting.
Yeah.
He's always positive.
Yeah.
Not necessarily positive things, but his attitude is always positive.
I think it's true, but you're very right to take me up on this, because now I would like to clarify this. I can see what I mean about that. I mean that the very fact that again and again and again he analyses these old positions in poem after poem, you know. I mean, the analysis going on in Esthétique du Mal, I chose that because I think it's the best there. I think it's, in fact, quite magnificent poem anyway. But he does it again and again, I mean, in Sunday Morning, and in A Side on Oboe, you know, and the very fact that so many poems deal with the same subject, so that reading more than 20 pages of Wallace Stevens is quite tedious sometimes, you know, it's got very much more to say. I get the feeling that the defensiveness comes out in the repetition of similarity, or something like that, of a from a non-ideological position, at a time when the sheer pressure of ideology on a man, you know, was that
what?
Oh, well, I hate to say that, but that's probably you. We must say that, you know, to downside ourselves back into that 30s, 40s period, I think what happens immediately is that one has to understand the pressure on towards allegiance. But it isn't visible in that period. It's quite heavy. The Japanese invasion, but the whole, you get up with a handful of dates, the main catastrophes between First World War and Second World War. There's this movement towards, all the time, particularly in America, towards structures to which you have allegiance, to feel fairly firm, you know, in this country too, of course. I mean, the movement towards fascism by the ruling classes is very strong. I mean, meaning big leaders supported by centralized cartel industry. That kind of security, you know. So that, you know, Clevedon House is in direct contact with the Junkers and the Ruhr bankers, you see, who supported Hitler. Because, I mean, everywhere you turn in that period, there is
the poetry either supports one kind of, or the literature supports one kind of religion or another. It's very difficult to find a man who is interested in a society which doesn't need any of this at all, and projecting it as an ideal. And I get the feeling that Wallace Stevens was fairly tough, as you said, but I do think within in there, there's a strong defensive element which comes out by the continual analysis.
Yeah.
You see, in that. If I make myself reasonably clear to you, Peter?
Yeah.
Good. And you? That's good. John?
If I could bear you well, in letter after letter, in the 40s particularly, it's an answer to various people refusing to be drawn into public controversies.
Right.
They are asking him to come out on
one side or another. Right.
Whether it's Pound or mm-hmm. the awarding of a Bollinger Prize or whatever.
Right.
Constantly saying, I won't get involved in this, it's too complicated, I don't want to make a statement which is going to be misinterpreted and misread.
Right. I think this is it. But I think it's a very vulnerable position, isn't it, D.C.? We found it in that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. I really must get those letters sometime. When, I really cannot say. I must say, I can't be amazing now. I think one of the few critics that you can look at that all makes any sense to me about Wallace Stevens, I wouldn't recommend any others, in fact, except is Ivor Winters, you know, in Defense of Reason. Which, I mean, I'm saying I disagree so much with what Winters did, but he's one of the few critics that I can read with any pleasure because he's so clear. You know exactly what he means, and you've got to answer clearly. You know what I mean? I mean, he doesn't fox you with all sorts of lumber. And what he says about Winters is, he accuses Winters, I mean, I say accuses, you must understand, he bears it out, it's just like a point blank sort of fine guy, of being a hedonist, that is, a man who has this egotistic sense of pleasure of being in the air. As if that was an accusation, by the way, which I wouldn't by any means use in that way. But I think there's a Puritan thing going on in Stevens, and he means by hedonism the doctrine that only the bodily sensations are real. Now, there's a lot of that in Stevens, isn't there? Because you see, if you are in fact a man without ideologies, and the man is interested in pleasure and very sensual in your poetry, clearly you do lay yourself open to the accusation of hedonism along those lines. I looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary to check it, because I noticed the dictionary says the doctrine that pleasure is the chief good. I quote, from the thing, the doctrine in Winters, the doctrine that only bodily sensations are real. Everybody uses an accusation. Also, this gives you an idea of the kind of thing you're finding in Winters. This is in Defense of Reason, page 441. Stevens appears to have slipped here into the old Whitmanian form of romantic error, common enough in our literature, but current especially in Stevens' generation, and espoused in particular by Stevens' friend W.C. Williams, the fallacy that the poet achieves salvation by being in some way intensely of and expressive of his country. I've never understood that. I should have thought of all the people Stevens, but you see now, I didn't understand that. I'm beginning to get it now, because I think that what Winters is getting at here is that in Whitman, and in Hart Crane, and in Emerson, and in Thoreau, and in Stevens, there is this very strong anarchistic structure, you know, of the man on his own judging himself by experience. You know, there's a notorious description by Raab about the thinness of the intellectuality of American poets, that their strength again and again comes out, American writers, in their full-blooded response to experience. In fact, it's been called by somebody in another essay the cult of experience in American literature. Do you see? Now, I think it would be very interesting for you to think about this, Stevens, as part of that cult of experience in American literature. That this, apart from the ones we've been talking about, there is in American exchange, Thoreau and Whitman, all these people, a reluctance to be committed to anything except empirical bodily experience. you know? He's in that line. Do I make myself clear? Lindsay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's clear. Is it clear to you, Pierre?
Yes.
Good. So I think it's important. Otherwise, I can't possibly see what Stevens means. Ivor Winters means there, do you see?
It's fair to keep that. You know, you just can't accept anything for them. Yeah.
Right.
He went on, even old proverbs have to be
right.
Accepted.
Yeah. Just, yeah, that's good, isn't it? Yeah. It's true. Sorry.
Could I throw in just a little bit?
Do, John. You're being very helpful with your letters, yeah.
I hope it is, and not just...
No, not at all, because I don't know them properly.
This is a very short letter, 1944, March 27th, to Theodore Weiss. Dear Mr. Weiss, as soon as I saw...
19 what, did you say?
1944.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Dear Mr. Weiss.
As soon as I saw what your letter of March 24th was about, I stopped reading it.
I don't know the guts.
This was at the end of the first paragraph. I have not yet read Mr. Winters' essay, but I have read a review of his book and gather that he considers my poems to be expressions of Patterian, Walter Pater, hedonism. Poems written over a long period of time express a good many things. Certainly the things that I have written recently are intended to express an agreement with reality. I need not say that what is back of hedonism is one thing, and what is back of a desire for agreement with reality is a different thing. There is also the possibility of an acceptable fictive alternative. I am, of course, not going to be drawn into any debate between you and Mr. Winters. Probably all three of us are equally concerned about the
same thing. This thing comes up again there, doesn't it? I mean, this, amongst, I think I'm just going to say anymore. Well, obviously, it must be very clearly what I mean, so I'm not going to rub it in. But I think it's bound to be, I think, for any man in such a condition. I'm not making an accusation, you understand. Okay, one of the things I've not looked at all is that one of the long poems, but it is relevant here, is The Comedian's Letter C. I think the interesting thing there is that somehow... you might, in fact, this moves out of the hedonism idea, that you might possibly use the phrase that he does use of a man condemned once more to a life of rich perceptions. You see, I mean, he was aware, Stephen. You see the quotation there I'm using, condemned once more to a life of rich perceptions, which is the description of the protagonist. Now, one of the things inside of the Comedian of the Letter C is that the sheer ability, this is, God, this is so much Keats again, Tony, the sheer, like, pressure of your, if you are the kind of person that's able to respond in this way, the sheer pressure of the response on you, you know, and your ability to do it is very difficult to get out of. And you might be encumbered by particulars. You see, the real would break up fragmentarily in terms of empirical sensation continually. Which is exactly Keats's position, wasn't it, too? Very, very strange that we're working on these two things together. So that then the problem becomes, well, how do you make order then? When, like, at every given point, your body is responding in this overwhelming way, you see. So that's why he says, condemn once more to a life of rich perceptions. And the answer is, of course, that one way of doing it, at least, is to steady and stabilize it by writing a poem. You see. And this is another way of attacking those people you'll find who are always accusing Stevens of writing poems about poetry, about poems. I think the way to tackle that one is that, okay, if you're to make articulations of sensation in language in order to stabilize what you have so it doesn't get fragmented, that's a very good subject. This immediately will then move on to the great poem of 1936 called Ideas of Order. And you see then, to move on from condemn once more to a life of rich perceptions, here is the two quotations from the poem. I think I'm being too sick about it, but I think it's one of the actual moves. The quotations are from wanting to write poems, I quote, poems of the act of the mind, and the incessant conjunctioning between things as they are and things imagined. You see, this is the next stage.
Perhaps the man with the car.
Yeah, right, that's another idea. Yeah, it's very much in there. Mm. Continuing this idea of the conjunctioning between imagination and the things as they are. The phrase is the incessant conjunctioning. The incessant conjunctioning between things as they are and things imagined. And in the poem called The Rock, which is the last poem in the collected poems, it's a paradox, it's a strategy of preventing you from the rigidity of single definition. You see? Right. That's the kind of thing that we looked at these other ideas. Look at the poem called The Planet on the Table. This is collected poems, page 532. Very late poem. The Planet on the Table. And you'll see, it's right at the very end of the book. Before, it's in the book, it's in the collection called The Rock at the end, which I say is the last thing. And it's a summing up of his career. It goes, Ariel was glad he had written his poems. They were of a remembered time or of something seen that he liked. Other makings of the sun were waste and welter. Reichsgrub writhed. Himself and the sun were one, and his poems, or their makings of himself, were not his makings of the sun. It was not important that they survived. What mattered was that they should bear some lineament or character, some affluence, if only half perceived, in the poverty of their words, of the planet of which they were part. It's a beautifully modest statement of what is possible. It's a total lack of arrogance of the idea that somehow that this revolutionary change is going to take place to these firms. But that's the use of affluence and poverty there. That is very important. Some affluence, if only half perceived in the poverty of their words, of the planet of which they were part. That is just the duty of the poet, as he sees it, and he seems to have achieved it, and I would agree, is to make representations of that affluent ecology of the planet on which we live. Just that. Which is like, exactly like the instance at the end of the Sunday morning, you know, the deer and the birds and the berries. The sense of that you must respond, like, at every point to the planet on which you live, record the affluence, but prevent yourself from reducing that affluence to the poverty of system. That abstraction is poverty again and again and again in his technique. So look at the Planet on the Table, one of his very last poems, in collected poems. John, you have something else?
Yeah, I've thrown in another one.
Yeah.
To Barbara Church, June 22nd, 1948. Thinking about the nature of our relation to what one sees out of the window, for example, without any effort to see to the bottom of things, may someday disclose a force capable of destroying nihilism.
Right. Yeah. This is it. I mean, because he knows darn well that nihilistic impulse comes again and again from the reductive urge, you know, so that things get levelled out. So that you take out the differences to get down to the nitty-gritty essences, and by the time you've done it, you haven't got very much. Which is like the act of making things poverty-stricken continually. So, and then I think the prose thing to just finally a few minutes on these, this book called The Necessary Angel. One or two very interesting things in here, but there's not an awful lot of it. I mean, it's quite short book, so you might look at one or two other things in here, particularly the essay called Imagination as Value. I think we don't have time for anything else. Clearly that would come to the point, you see, that we'll have to move into reading these essays, that bit of thing generally, you get an impression of a very well-read man. in certain spheres. You get the impression of a man who's read an awful lot of philosophy and has understood it, which is rare. I mean, you really get the thing, he's got a grip on it. But when he talks about Leibniz and monads, you get the thing, he's a darn well what he's talking about. It's not just like Kelsall, you know, grubbing around and things. So this is a discussion of imagination as value here. Let me just quote a passage or two of this comment. Where he says, my final point then is that the imagination is the power that enables us to perceive the normal in the abnormal, the opposite of chaos in chaos. It does this every day in arts and letters. This may seem to be a merely capricious statement, for ordinarily we regard the imagination as abnormal per se. That point of view was approached in the reference to the academic struggle between reason and the imagination, and again in the reference to the relationship between the imagination and social form. So this position towards a point of view derogatory to the imagination is an aversion to the abnormal. We see it in the common attitude towards modern art and letters. The exploits of Rambo in poetry, if Rambo can any longer be called modern, and of Kafka in prose, are deliberate exploits of the abnormal. It is natural for us to identify the imagination with those that extend it to abnormality. It's like identifying liberty with those that abuse it. And literature overfull of abnormality, and certainly present-day European literature as one knows it, seems to be a literature full of abnormality, gives a reason, an appearance of normality, to which it is not solely entitled. The truth seems to be that we live in concepts of the imagination before the reason has established them. If this is true, then reason is simply the methodizer of the imagination. It may be that the imagination is a miracle of logic, and that its exquisite divinations are calculations beyond analysis, as the conclusions of the reason are calculations wholly within analysis. If so, one understands perfectly the remark that in the service of love and imagination, nothing could be too lavish, too sublime, or too festive. And I'll keep it a little bit, and he goes on to say, one statement does not demonstrate the other. The two statements together imply that the instantaneous disclosures of living are disclosures of the normal. This will seem absurd to those that insist on the solitude and misery and terror of the world. They will ask, of what value is the imagination to them? And if their experience is to be considered, how is it possible to deny that they live in an imagination of evil? Is evil normal or abnormal? Which is a question, by the way. And how do the exquisite divinations of the poets, and for that matter, even the Orioles of the Saints, help them? But when we speak of perceiving the normal, we have in mind the instinctive integration of the reasons for living. Of what value is anything to the solitary and those that live in misery and terror, except imagination? I think that single paragraph, I mean, again, given time, we could analyze that. It takes a great deal of Stevens. I recommend it for close watch, you know? It's in the essay called Imagination of Value, page 153 of The Necessary Angel. Particularly that. There's very interesting, like, deliberations, not too dogmatic, I don't think, between the normal and the abnormal when it comes to imagination and evil, as you see. There are crucial points there. I mean, is Rambo abnormal? It's a good question to ask. Because then immediately, standards of bulk, of quantity, and quality emerge, don't they? And what is the standardized vision of the human? Is imagination a derogatory act in a life where, for most people, the pressure of misery, terror, and solitude is considerable? You see, the kind of questions here are very involved ones, and a very good one. I think, in fact, the question, is evil normal or abnormal, is something which is so, second half of the 20th century, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's exactly what Norman Mailer's talking about the whole time, because he can't make up his mind. And who can? You know, I mean, the idea that maybe there isn't a Manichaean structure, but the devil structure has been strong. You remember in Mailer's The Deer Park, Marianne Faye, believes the old medieval belief that maybe that Satan didn't turn God out, but they changed positions. You know, which kind of undermines paradise lost a little bit. You know, this idea, there's always, this is a perverse human idea that you find in the Middle Ages, like, of inverting the process there. But I only mention it because it seems to me that Stevens is right in the center here. The tone, too, of it may be that, notice, is typical of Stevens, a strong desire not to commit himself to ideological positions, which he would have to retract as soon as he began thinking again. I think he's a bit perverse sometimes about this in his and I say that on the basis of like the complete poems and essays. I get the feeling that okay, this defensive thing again is what we're concerned with, you know, that way. But look at that. The other thing you might look at is in of the, I don't want to give you an awful lot of the prose, but in the Opus Posthumus, you might notice it's in the introduction. You might skip. It's on page it's on the page 14 of the introduction. It's in Roman figures X1b, and the introducer here quotes a memorandum that Stevens wrote for Henry Church at a time when you needn't go into this in any detail, of course. But the idea was that they were going to form a chair of poetry at Princeton University in 1940, and someone wrote to Stevens, a friend of his, about it. And he wrote already then in 40 this kind of thing. You can see how relevant this is to what we've been seeing.